This episode will cover the heart and neck vessel assessment following chapter 20 of the Jarvis textbook. First, let's start with a quick review of heart anatomy and physiology. Try tracing a blood cell as it moves throughout the cardiovascular system, starting anywhere in the body. It will return to the heart through either the superior vena cava or the inferior vena cava into the right atrium. It will then go through the tricuspid valve into the right ventricle, then through the pulmonary valve into the pulmonary artery, which goes to the lungs. The blood cells then return through the pulmonary veins into the left atrium, then goes through the mitral valve into the left ventricle, then through the aortic valve into the aorta. The aorta then feeds the blood to the body. Next, recall that systole is the phase when the ventricles squeeze blood out of the heart. Diastole is the phase when the heart relaxes so that it can fill back up with blood. The chest wall over the heart is called the precordium. The easiest landmark to find in the precordium is the sternum, right down the middle. Most of the ribs are attached to the sternum, and the spaces in between the ribs are called intercostal spaces. In this chapter, we will also look at three important blood vessels in the neck: the internal jugular vein, the external jugular vein, and the carotid artery. These blood vessels are included in this chapter because they are so closely connected to the heart that when you assess these blood vessels, you are almost assessing the heart itself. Subjective data. As always, you will want to ask about personal or family cardiac history and any relevant risk factors for cardiac conditions such as diet, weight, exercise, smoking, and alcohol use. Also, ask about any medications the client is taking. Chest pain is an important topic that deserves a bit of discussion. Flip forward to Table 20.2 for a lot of great information about the most common distinguishing characteristics of different types of chest pain. As a quick aside on terminology, recall that ischemia means inadequate blood supply, so cardiovascular ischemic chest pain is chest pain caused by inadequate blood supply to the heart. When this happens suddenly, it is called acute coronary syndrome, and a type of acute coronary syndrome is myocardial infarction, which is more commonly called a heart attack. It is most important that you familiarize yourself with the typical description of cardiovascular ischemic chest pain, as this is the most dangerous condition that is most specifically linked to chest pain. Notice that there are some details which are very specific to ischemic chest pain and can act as easily identifiable red flags, such as chest pain that is described as crushing or squeezing, or pain that radiates up to the jaw or shoulder. But it is equally important to understand the significance of the small sentence found in row 3, column 3. Quote, "or there may be no pain and only associated symptoms," end quote. This is especially true for women, who frequently present with different and less specific symptoms than men. Try imagining a woman who is having a heart attack who comes to a busy emergency room and tells the triage nurse that her chief complaint is indigestion and nausea. Think of how easy it would be for such a woman to have a delayed diagnosis or even to be completely misdiagnosed and sent home. But just as people can have heart attacks without chest pain, people can also have chest pain for reasons other than a heart attack. If you take a look at Table 20.2, you will notice that many of the distinctive features of different types of chest pain logically correspond to their etiology. For example, chest pain caused by a breathing problem often gets worse with deep breathing or coughing. Chest pain caused by a gastrointestinal problem often gets worse with eating or lying down. Chest pain caused by a musculoskeletal problem is worse with movement and can sometimes be reproduced by moving or palpating a part of the chest. Psychogenic chest pain is often accompanied by symptoms of depression and anxiety. That's all I'll say about chest pain for this episode. Let's get back to talking about other subjective data we should gather. Dyspnea, which is just a fancy word for shortness of breath, is another very important symptom when assessing heart function. Related symptoms include orthopnea, which is when a patient feels the dyspnea when lying down. Clients with orthopnea naturally have trouble sleeping and often need multiple pillows to prop up their body. Sometimes a change in the severity of orthopnea can be detected when a client says that previously only two pillows were required to avoid dyspnea when sleeping, but now three pillows are required. If the dyspnea wakes the individual up at night, this is called paroxysmal nocturnal dyspnea. Dyspnea can easily be confused as a lung problem, but if you think back to the last time when you did really strenuous exercise, the shortness of breath you felt wasn't just from your lungs trying to compensate for the extra oxygen requirements, it was also your beating heart. If either the lungs or the heart were not able to compensate properly, you would have experienced worse dyspnea. Edema, nocturia, and cough are also included in subjective data relevant to the heart. Nocturia is when one has to wake up in the middle of the night to urinate. At first, these three may seem to be completely unrelated, but the common denominator across all three is that they can be caused by fluid overload. This is because heart failure causes fluid overload. This is such a significant part of the pathophysiology of heart failure that it is often called congestive heart failure, the word congestive referring to the congestion of fluid. When this fluid buildup happens in the legs, it causes edema. When fluid buildup happens in the kidneys, it causes nocturia. When fluid buildup happens in the lungs, it causes a cough. Objective data in the neck. This is a good time, while your mind is on the subject of fluid buildup, to pivot to objective data findings in the neck. I mentioned earlier that the internal and external jugular veins are important because they are so closely connected to the heart. To be more specific, they are directly connected to the right atrium of the heart. Recall that all of the blood coming from throughout your entire body, except the lungs, converges on the right atrium through either the superior vena cava or the inferior vena cava. Imagine driving during rush hour on a major freeway that will eventually merge with another freeway. As you approach closer and closer to the merging point, traffic will gradually get slower and slower. Once you get to within a quarter mile from the merging point, you're so close that you're pretty much experiencing at that moment the same thing you will be experiencing when you actually get to the merging point. By this same principle, when you look at the jugular veins, they are so closely connected to the right atrium that you're pretty much looking at what's happening in the right atrium. The pressure in the right atrium is called the central venous pressure, or CVP. Heart failure causes an increase in CVP, and that increase can be seen in the jugular veins. Figure 20.10 shows how to find the external and internal jugular veins relative to the sternomastoid muscle. For a healthy adult, the external jugular vein should be visible when lying down and then disappear when sitting up. This is because in an upright position, gravity helps blood drain from the jugular veins, and gravity also fights against blood coming back to the heart up from the legs. When lying flat, the jugular veins no longer have the assistance of gravity, and it is much easier for the fluid to flow from the legs back to the heart, which competes with blood trying to flow out of the external jugular vein. The easiest way to assess the external jugular vein is with the client on an adjustable examination table. Start with the client lying flat and use tangential lighting to locate the vein. Keep your eye on that vein as you adjust the angle of the bed up, and you should see it disappear. If the jugular vein is still visible past 45 degrees, this is called jugular vein distension, or JVD. Moving on to the internal jugular vein, again, look at figure 20.10 in the book to see how most of it is covered by the sternomastoid, but there is a portion of it in the upper neck that is not covered. The internal jugular vein will pulse as the heart beats, but not in the simple way that an artery pulses, going up and down with systole and then diastole. The jugular venous pulse has a much more complicated waveform, and you can see it in figure 20.12. Your goal for now is to locate that pulse. Understanding the details of this waveform is beyond the scope of this episode. Once you have located the pulse, the instructions for how to use it to assess central venous pressure is a bit more complicated than for the external jugular vein, which is why you will find it in the Procedures for Advanced Practice subsection. The instructions are difficult to explain in words, so I will refer you to that portion of your textbook and include a link in the episode notes as well. But keep in mind that these are all different ways of assessing for the same thing, that is, increased central venous pressure. The third vessel in the neck to assess is the carotid artery. When palpating the carotid artery, be sure to palpate only one side at a time and do not apply excessive pressure or massage the area. Next, auscultate the artery with the bell of the stethoscope to assess for the presence of a bruit, spelled bruit. A bruit is a swishing sound and an abnormal finding caused by turbulence in the blood flowing through an area. It helps to have the client hold his or her breath during auscultation. Objective data in the precordium. First, inspect the precordium with your eyes. In addition to assessing the skin and the hair, look for the apical impulse, which is a faint vibration caused by the beating of the heart. You may be able to see it in someone with a thin chest wall, but not finding one is normal as well. An abnormal finding would be a prominent pulsation called a lift or a heave. Begin palpating at the top of the sternum, running your fingers down until you feel the bony ridge called the sternal angle. From there, run your fingers diagonally on either side until your fingers are in between two ribs. This is a second intercostal space. This is probably the most useful landmark in the chest, so I will say it again. Find the sternal angle and go diagonally to either side to find the second intercostal space. Work your way down to the fourth intercostal space on the left side, and then follow it until your fingers hit an imaginary line that runs up and down the body halfway between midline and the patient's side. This is called the midclavicular line. The apical impulse can be felt around this area. If you can't feel it, try rolling the patient onto his or her left side. If you still can't feel it, that can be a normal finding as well, especially for a client with a thick chest wall. A normal apical impulse should be small, only about a finger pad in size, and feel like a quick and gentle tap. Next, we will assess five specific locations in the precordium. Four of these areas are named after heart valves, and a fifth is called Erb's Point. In order of assessment, the first letters from each of these areas form the acronym APETM, which you can remember using the phrase, all pigs eat too much, which also begins with the letters APETM. A stands for aortic valve, and it is found in the second intercostal space on the right sternal border. Simply move across the sternum and you'll hit the pulmonic area in the second intercostal space on the left sternal border. Move straight down to the next intercostal space, staying glued to the left sternal border to find Erb's Point. Then move down two more intercostal spaces, still sticking to the left sternal border to find the tricuspid valve area. Finally, slide your finger along that intercostal space until you hit the midclavicular line and you found the mitral valve area. Note that you were just here to palpate the apical impulse. When assessing these areas, it's important to hit these exact locations, but also the areas around and in between. Treat them as signposts marking the trail you should follow. First, assess these areas for a vibration, which would be called a thrill, using the parts of your hand best suited to transmit vibrations, either the point where your fingers meet your palm or the ulnar side of your hand. Normally, there is no thrill. Then, auscultate these areas, first with the diaphragm and then with the bell. Normally, a heartbeat sounds like lub-dub, lub-dub, lub-dub. The lub sound is called S1, and it is made by the two atrioventricular valves slamming shut at the beginning of systole. The dub sound is called S2, and it is made by the aortic and pulmonic valves, which slam shut at the end of systole. Notice that even though the sounds are coming from four valves, because each pair of valves close at the exact same time, you should normally only hear two distinct sounds. However, in some individuals, it is normal finding to hear a split S2 during inspiration. This happens because the aortic valve and the pulmonic valve are closing at slightly different times. As long as this is only heard during inspiration, this is considered a normal finding. If the split persists during expiration as well as inspiration, that is an abnormal finding called a fixed split S2. This is abnormal, but it is not an extra heart sound. It's just two normally occurring sounds which happen slightly apart from one another instead of occurring simultaneously. Two of the most common extra heart sounds are called S3 and S4. It probably will not surprise you to know that the S3 sound is heard after S2, and then the S4 sound is heard after S3. Imagining the S3 sound is as easy as remembering the word Kentucky, where the first two syllables are S1 and S2, and the last syllable is S3. Listen as I say it, Kentucky, Kentucky. Notice that it comes immediately after S2, and also notice that it is relatively low-pitched, Kentucky, Kentucky. To imagine the S4 sound, think of the word Tennessee, where the first syllable is the extra S4 sound, and the next two syllables correspond to S1 and S2. S4 is heard first because it occurs at the very end of diastole, immediately before the next heartbeat begins. It is pronounced this way, tenesi, tenesi. Notice that the extra sound is, again, low-pitched. By the way, these low-pitched sounds are the reason why you need to get in the habit of auscultating with both the diaphragm and the bell of the stethoscope. It may seem tedious and unnecessary as you practice on healthy individuals without extra heart sounds, but you need to build good habits now. The last extra heart sound I will discuss here is the most common one, the mid-systolic click. As its name suggests, it is a click heard in the middle of systole, so it is fairly easy to imagine and recognize, but I want to stop and take a closer look to help connect the dots between the basic heart anatomy and physiology you have previously learned and this abnormal finding. The first question we could ask is, what is unique about this particular point in the cardiac cycle? Whatever this sound is, it seems to always pick the middle of systole, so there must be something unique happening here. It may help to look at a Wiggers diagram of the cardiac cycle as you try to answer this question, which is included in your textbook as figure 20.6. The diagram makes this question relatively easy to identify. The middle of systole is the point where ventricular pressure reaches its peak. The next question we could ask is, during this point in time, when ventricular pressure is at its peak, which part of the heart is under the most stress and is most likely to fail? The answer to this question is the mitral valve. Remember that the job of the mitral valve during systole is to prevent blood from flowing back into the left atrium. This is a difficult job, and the middle of systole is where the job is the most difficult. For individuals with a condition known as mitral valve prolapse, the mitral valve is initially able to hold back the blood, but when the ventricular pressure approaches its peak, the valve pops open, allowing blood to begin leaking backward. The popping open of the valve causes the mid-systolic click. That's all I will mention about extra heart sounds for this episode, but let's stick with mitral valve prolapse to introduce the next type of sound to auscultate for. I mentioned two abnormal things that happen for a client with mitral valve prolapse. One, the mitral valve pops open, which causes the click, but also two, blood begins leaking through the opening in the mitral valve, and this will cause blood to continue leaking until the end of systole. This causes a swooshing shh sound called a murmur. There are countless different types of murmurs caused by a wide variety of conditions, but regardless of type, all murmurs should be evaluated on the following parameters. Timing. At what point in the cardiac cycle is the sound heard? Loudness, graded on a scale of 1 through 6. Pitch, which can either be high or medium or low. Pattern, which describes whether the volume increases or decreases from the start to the end of the murmur. If you play music, you'll probably recognize the terms crescendo and decrescendo. Quality, what does it sound like? Location and radiation, where is the murmur most easily heard? Posture, does changing the posture of the patient from squatting to sitting to standing change the murmur in any way? Abnormal findings of heart failure. If you look at table 20.3 in the textbook, you will see an illustration of an individual with heart failure, showing a wide range of clinical manifestations. Instead of repeating all of them here, I'll only take a minute to show how many of these can be conceptually understood. To start, recall that there are two sides to the heart, and each side functions as a pump. The right ventricle receives blood from the body and pumps blood forward to the lungs. The left ventricle receives blood from the lungs and pumps blood forward to the body. In an individual with heart failure, these pumps are failing to do their job. And when a pump fails to do its job, it causes two different problems. Upstream from the pump, there is a backup of fluid. Downstream from the pump, there is low output. Keeping this image in your mind, focus just on the left side of a failing heart. The left side of the heart receives blood from the lungs and pumps blood forward to the body. So the first problem caused by the left heart failing to do its job is a backup of fluid in the lungs, which are upstream from the left heart. This buildup of fluid will cause fluid to spill into the lungs, causing crackles, cough, and dyspnea. The second problem caused by the left heart failing to do its job is low output to the body, which is downstream from the left heart. This low output of blood to the body will cause pale skin, weak pulses, and decreased blood pressure. When the right heart fails, this causes a backup of fluid in the body, which is upstream from the right heart. This buildup of fluid in the body will cause jugular vein distension, fluid buildup in the legs causing pitting edema, fluid buildup inside the abdomen, fluid buildup in the spleen and the liver. You get the idea. I hope that this is a helpful framework to try to conceptually link a few of these various clinical manifestations rather than trying to memorize an arbitrary list. But do keep in mind that it is an oversimplification. The left and the right sides of the heart are connected, so a lot of these clinical manifestations will be affected by both sides. For example, dyspnea can be from fluid buildup behind the left heart or because of inadequate blood flow from the right heart. And with that, I will conclude this episode on the heart and neck vessels. Thanks for listening.